This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. There are a lot of theories about why food allergies, asthma, celiac disease, and intestinal disorders like Crohn's disease have been on the rise. Our first guest, Dr. Martin Blaser, speculates it may be connected to the overuse of antibiotics, which has resulted in killing off strains of bacteria that typically live in the gut. Blaser's an expert on the human microbiome, which is the collection of bacteria, viruses, fungi, and other microbes that live in and on the body. In fact, about 70 to 90% of all the cells in the human body aren't human at all. They're microorganisms. Blaser is the director of the Human Microbiome Program, former chair of medicine at NYU, and former president of the Infectious Diseases Society of America. His new book is called Missing Microbes: How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. He spoke with Terry last Monday.
Dr. Martin Blaser, welcome to Fresh Air. So when there are imbalances in the microbiome, things can go wrong. And you say that scientists now are beginning to think that some of what's often described as the modern plagues of medicine today, that some of those might be caused by imbalances of these microbes. So what are the, quote, modern plagues that you're talking about?
Yeah, and that's a good place to start. Since World War II, we've seen big rises in a number of diseases: asthma, allergies, food allergies, wheat allergy, juvenile diabetes, obesity, autism. These are all diseases that have gone up dramatically in the last 50 or 70 years. And one of the questions is, why are they going up? Are they going up for 10 different reasons? Or perhaps there's one reason that's fueling all of them.
And your theory is that one reason might be the microbiome?
My theory is that the one reason is the changing microbiome, that we evolved a certain stable situation with our microbiome, and with the modern advances of modern life, including modern medical practices, we have been disrupting the microbiome, and there's evidence for that, especially early in life. And it's changing how our children develop. That's my big theory. That's what I expound in the book.
Well, I will say that people who are involved in environmental issues think that it's, you know, toxins in the environment that are causing a lot of these, you know, quote, modern plagues. And people who deal with food and nutrition issues think that it's like, you know, bad nutrition and, you know, fatty foods and fast food. Empty calories that's causing a lot of today's modern plagues, and your specialty is the human microbiome, and you think it's that. So, you know, I just wanted to point that out to everybody. Everybody thinks
I don't discount those, and in fact, mm-hmm. nothing says that causation has to be exclusive.
Right,
causation could be additive,
mm-hmm.
and in fact, we have experiments in mice where, since we're very interested in obesity, if we put mice on a high-fat diet, they gain weight. They get fat. If we put them on antibiotics early in life, they also get fat. And if we put them on both together, they get very fat. And we've done this in male mice. We've done this in female mice. It's clear that the effects of the antibiotics potentiate the effects of the high-fat diet. So it's not, we're not letting high-fat diet off the hook. We're saying there's another factor there.
Well, that's really interesting. And why would antibiotics contribute to obesity?
Yeah, well, I'm very glad you asked that question. We've been interested in this for more than 10 years. And it began with all of a sudden the light bulb went off. We know that farmers have been feeding antibiotics to their farm animals, to their livestock, for almost 70 years. And the reason they do that is that it promotes their growth. They grow fast, bigger, faster. They use their food more efficiently to convert food calories into body mass. And one day I thought, well, if farmers are using antibiotics to promote the growth in their livestock, is it possible that the antibiotics we're using in children are doing the same thing? And that's why we began to do studies in mice.
Now, I thought the antibiotics in farm animals were being used to prevent them from getting sick because they're in factory farming, the animals are so close together. It's a very unhealthy situation, and it's easy to get sick, and then it's easy for disease to spread.
Yes, that's true, that it is, just as you say, that because they're close together, there's a lot of contagion. But the reason that the farmers are using the antibiotics is to promote growth. And again, there's a literature going back to the 1940s that shows that the use of subtherapeutic antibiotics, these aren't therapeutic levels, these are subtherapeutic levels, they're efficient at increasing growth. And in reality, the farmers and the farm scientists figured out a lot of this stuff years ago, and in one sense we're rediscovering it, because the question is, why should it work? Why does that work? And then it brings us back to the microbiome and the idea that there's a choreography, there's a normal developmental cycle of the microbiome from birth over the first few years of life, especially the first 3 years appear to be the most important. And that's how nature has, how we have evolved together so that we can maximize health and create a new generation, which is nature's great purpose. And because of modern practices, we have disrupted that. And then the question is, does that have consequence? And our studies in mice show that it does have consequences. We've done epidemiologic studies in people that show that some of these modern practices are increasing the risk of obesity as well.
You mentioned that the microbiome is developed during the first 3 years of life. And there's something you write about in the book that just, I hadn't heard this before. I found it so interesting that when the baby passes through the birth canal, that it develops some of its microbiome. I want you to explain that.
So as far as we know, when the baby is inside the womb, it is apparently sterile. There are some people who actually question this too. But the big moment of truth is when the membranes rupture, the water breaks, and the baby starts coming out. And that's where they first get exposed to the bacteria of the world. And the first bacteria they are exposed to is their mother's bacteria in the birth canal. So as labor proceeds, the babies are in contact with the microbes lining their mother's vagina, and as they're going out, they're covered by these bacteria. They swallow the bacteria. It's on their skin. They're a soup of these bacteria. That's their initial exposure to the world of bacteria.
And you're saying that's a good thing. That's an important thing.
Well, that's how mammals have been doing it for the last 150 million years, whether they're dolphins or elephants or humans. And that's how it's been done. And we know a little about what those bacteria are. The most common bacteria are lactobacillus. And there's evidence that over the course of pregnancy, the microbiome in the vagina changes just as many other parts of the body are changing. The microbiome is changing in its composition in terms of maximizing lactobacilli. And these are bacteria that eat lactose, which is the main component of milk. So the baby's mouth is filled with lactobacilli. The first thing that happens is they go up against their mom's breast and they inoculate the nipple with lactobacilli. And now milk and lactobacilli go into the new baby, and that's the foundation for their microbiome. And that's how they start their life.
So you're proposing that cesarean births might compromise the microbiome of the baby?
Well, actually, a very important study was done by Maria Gloria Dominguez and Rob Knight. And I think it's particularly important because Gloria is my wife. She did a study of moms who had C-sections or moms who gave birth vaginally. And shortly after birth, they compared the microbiomes in the babies that came out. And the babies that were born vaginally, their microbiome, not surprisingly, looked like the mom's vagina everywhere in the body, in their GI tract, on their skin, and their mouth. But the babies born by C-section, their microbiome looked like skin. And it didn't even necessarily look like the mom's skin. Maybe it was somebody else in the operating room. So it's clear that the microbiome is different immediately depending on the kind of birth.
So it's different, but we don't know for sure what that difference means?
We don't know what that means, but there have been more and more epidemiologic studies asking the question, really for the first time, are there long-term health consequences of being born by C-section? We did a study in England. A cohort of more than 10,000 children was enrolled in the early 1990s. and in which the investigators followed these kids for a number of years, took lots of measurements, and we asked the question, was there a difference in how their rate of getting fat or getting obese when they were 3, 7, 15, whether they were born by C-section or vaginally? And our study showed that kids born by C-section were more likely to have increased fat than the other kids. And this is one of four studies that has been appeared in the last 2 years showing exactly the same thing. In Boston, our study in England, a study in Canada, a study in Brazil, all showing the same thing.
So you mentioned a very do-it-yourself kind of compensatory procedure of using cotton gauze. Would you explain that?
Well, this was actually, this was my wife, Gloria's idea, and that is that if babies born by C-section are deprived of the natural microbiota that they would have gotten through birth canal delivery, why shouldn't we restore that? And so she's done an, she's conducting an experiment. It's been approved by the Institutional Review Board, in which she has three groups of mothers: vaginal birth, C-section birth, and then C-section with a swab in the vagina. Now when the baby's born, the baby gets swabbed with this cotton swab with vaginal contents so as to restore that which has been missed by the C-section.
It's too soon to see what the results are, right?
She's just analyzing the data now, and she's going to present this work at a big national meeting next month.
Dr. Martin Blaser speaking with Terry last Monday. Blaser's new book is Missing Microbes: How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies sitting in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Dr. Martin Blaser, author of the new book Missing Microbes: How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. Blaser speculates that the rise in chronic conditions like obesity, asthma, Crohn's disease, eczema, and juvenile diabetes is connected to changes in the human microbiome, the collection of microorganisms that live in and on our bodies. Most of the bacteria in the human microbiome, including bacteria essential to digestion and immunity, live in the gut, where they're vulnerable to antibiotics.
So you were describing your concern that if a woman during childbirth or an infant is given antibiotics that might affect the baby's microbiome, and who knows how long that would last, the effects of that would last, maybe a short time, maybe forever, we don't really know yet, but you're concerned about the imbalance it would create. A lot of children get ear infections, and as a result of the ear infections, they get antibiotics. And for some children, it's recurrent ear infections, which means more doses of antibiotics. What are your concerns about the ear infections and the antibiotics?
So that's a very important issue because, as you point out, ear infections are very common in children. And in the United States, we're giving a very high percentage of these kids antibiotics every time they have an ear infection. And that's not the only way to practice medicine. First, we know that most of those ear infections are not caused by bacteria at all. They're caused by viruses. And antibiotics don't work against viral infections. That's very clear. So one of the problems is that the doctor can't really easily distinguish between viral infections and bacterial infections. But to some degree, they can. And I want to contrast what we're doing in the United States with Sweden, where they have just as good health care, and maybe people live even longer. In the U.S., the average child is getting about four courses of antibiotics by the time they're three. That's across the entire United States. Some kids are more, some kids are less. In Sweden, instead of four courses, it's 1.4 courses. And by the age of 10 in the U.S., the average child has gotten between 10 and 11 courses. And in Sweden, it's about four courses. So at every age, they're using fewer antibiotics. And Swedes are not that biologically different from us, but the practice of medicine is different, and culturally it's different. And we here in the U.S., we know that we're overusing antibiotics, but every parent with their screaming child, an uncomfortable child, isn't willing to bite the bullet because they think that maybe the antibiotics could help them. But if
understandably, I might say, you know.
Yes, understandably. But if the antibiotics have cost, if every time you took an antibiotic, perhaps it raised the risk in a child that they would get obesity or asthma or diabetes by 1%, and that the risk is cumulative, and I'm just making up these numbers just to give an example, then maybe the mom would say, well, in that case, maybe I should just wait a day or two and see if the baby's going to get well. And of course, in most cases, the baby does get well. So we've been giving antibiotics based on benefit without thinking that there might be long-term costs. And if there are costs, then the whole equation changes.
Well, you're also asking if changes in the human microbiome might be contributing to the rise in allergies, like food allergies?
Yes, yes. Well, so the question is, why does someone become allergic to a food? And why has the rate of food allergies increased so dramatically? Peanut allergies, when I was growing up, were very rare. Now they're pretty common. And even if you say that there's some overdiagnosis, still at their nubbin, these have increased tremendously. So why should someone become sensitized to the food they eat? It all has to do with the formation of the immune system, how the immune system differentiates between self and non-self. And what's training the immune system is the early life microbiome that is setting the context under which immune development occurs.
Explain that a little more for me, like how if the bacteria and other microorganisms in my gut are out of balance, that might lead to a food allergy.
Well, part of what I'm going to say is speculation, because I don't know the exact mechanisms, but what I can tell you is that our immune system is quite complex. There are many different kinds of immune cells. There are cells that strongly recognize foreign substances. There are ones that try to damp it down and down-regulate it. There's what we call innate immunity, which is the immunity we're all born with. And then there's the adaptive immunity, the immunity that develops when we experience different kinds of exposures. So it's very complex. It's developing early in life, and that's what sets, in essence, immunological tone that will determine how allergic a person is or how, let's say, stoical a person is in an immunologic sense. That's the idea.
Part of your concern in general is that, you know, the overuse of antibiotics, and as you point out in the book, sometimes it's hard to tell. It's hard for a doctor to tell whether an infection is caused by a virus or bacteria. So I'm going to use myself as an example right now. I have a cold. My cold sometimes end in laryngitis. My past history shows that sometimes, not always, but sometimes, like if I'm running a low-grade fever and I have a cold and I'm losing my voice, an antibiotic is really going to be helpful. But maybe that's just coincidence. Who knows? But the doctors don't seem to have a definitive way of knowing, you know, if my cold or your cold or anyone's cold is bacterial or viral, unless they do a test that, you know, most doctors, I think, don't do. I mean, I know they can, if you have the symptoms, they'll find out if you have strep throat or not, and strep is a bacteria, so that would be definitive. But I'm just wondering, why isn't there, like, an easier test to determine, for instance, whether what I have is viral or bacterial?
Yeah, so a wonderful, important question.
Especially for me now.
Yeah, especially for you. But I want to first say that as far as I know, you're not 3 years old. So there are two scenarios that are important. One is the infections of young children while they're developing, and the other is infections in adults who are fully developed. And my biggest concern is about development. Mm-hmm. But now let's turn to you.
Okay.
And that is that actually a lot of technology exists so that we could tell you what's the cause of your infection right now. But it's very expensive. And there's just no medical necessity or rationale for it, because in general, your cold is going to get better 95 times out of 100. And what you know is that when you take the antibiotic, the next day you feel better. But what you don't know is what would have happened if you didn't take the antibiotic. And there have been studies of people with conditions like you, and in most cases, the antibiotic effect is zero or marginal. So, again, our custom is to treat with antibiotics. I want to bring up a point that might be of interest to you that bears on this question, and that is that last year the CDC published a survey of antibiotic use in the United States. And what they found is that in 2010, there were 258 million courses of antibiotics prescribed. And in our country, that comes out to 833 courses per 1,000 population, or about 5 courses for every 6 people. And from talking to the investigators at the CDC, this seems stable over a period of years. So our use of antibiotics is enormous. What was particularly interesting to me was the regional differences in antibiotic use. In the North and in the Midwest, it was about at the national average. In the West, it was way lower than the national average. It was about 630. And in the South, it was way higher. It was about 930. So between the West and the South, there was about a 50% difference in the prescribing of antibiotics. And I can tell you, as a specialist in infectious diseases, there is not a 50% difference in the rate of serious bacterial infections. So this difference in usage is a difference in culture, in practice, in expectations. And I think that's part of what we're up against.
So can you explain why it's so expensive to determine whether my cold is caused by a bacteria or virus, or whether a baby's ear infection is caused by a bacteria or virus? Considering the strides that we've made in medicine, it seems like that shouldn't be that big a deal. You know, you culture it, you look under the microscope, and you see which it is. But apparently it's not that simple.
Well, the technology is there. It just hasn't been employed because there's never been a necessity. If you give every child, when a child comes in with some kind of upper respiratory infection, the chance that they'll walk out of the doctor's office with an antibiotic is 70% to 80%. And that's improved over what it used to be. So there's no economic necessity driving it. And so we haven't really employed the technologies that we have available and produce them on a mass level and try to get economies of scale. But I think we should. I think we need... We've been living under this antibiotic umbrella, which has many very positive effects. But I'm concerned about the hidden long-term effects. And once we start to accurately count them, then we're going to have to start cutting back on antibiotic use. And therefore, we're going to have to develop much better diagnostics, and we're going to have to use those diagnostics. And I think the main thrust of antibiotic research in the last 50 years has been making broad-spectrum antibiotics. So if a child comes in with an ear infection, you can treat them with a certain antibiotic, and you know that it will cover all the important bacteria. But I think we should have diagnostics that will say, first, is it viral or bacterial? And if it's bacterial, which bacteria is it? And then the doctor can pull that agent off the shelf and say, okay, I'm going to treat your Haemophilus infection just with a Haemophilus-specific antibiotic so it won't do any collateral damage. We don't have those agents yet, but it wouldn't be that hard to develop them. The major issue right now is cost.
Well, Dr. Martin Blaser, thank you for talking with us.
And thank you for having me on your show.
Dr. Martin Blaser spoke with Terry last Monday. Blaser is the author of Missing Microbes: How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. You can read the first chapter on our website, freshair.npr.org. The Both is the name for the duo formed by veteran singer-songwriters Amy Mann and Ted Leo. The Both is also the name of their debut album. The two began performing together in 2012, when Ted Leo was Mann's opening act. Mann began joining Leo on stage during his set. They liked the way their voices sounded together and started collaborating. Rock critic Ken Tucker has this review of The Both.
The ball dropped in the cold light, dawning on a cold eastern morning. Not shocked, can't be too apart when there were so many. Anymore. Shoes on, but the
That's Amy Mann and Ted Leo harmonizing on a song they co-wrote called The Gambler. As separate acts, Ted Leo is generally considered a punk-influenced indie musician for the work he's done with his band The Pharmacists. And Amy Mann as a sensitive singer-songwriter ever since she left the pop star life with the group Till Tuesday in the 1980s. But of course, both of these musicians are more than their genre categories. What their work as the both suggests is that together, they've found common ground in confidently precise, propulsive melodies and lyrics that twist with oblique cleverness. That's Milwaukee, one of the first songs Mann and Leo collaborated on in gradually hatching this plan to perform and record together as the both. They bring out the best in each other musically. Leo gives Mann zip and vigor, she gives him poetry and hard-headedness. Sometimes one of them takes the lead vocal, at other times they trade off lines and harmonize throughout. On a song such as You Can't Help Me Now, they make gloomy sentiments lively.
Anytime you establish a world of your own, you get thrown. Try and answer a bomb with a calm undertone. Alone. I wanted you to know that I put up a fight. Everything goes missing when they're down the line. The catastrophic sinking of the will is kind. And even you can't help me now. You can't help. You can't help me now. You can't help.
In interviews, Amy Mann has said working with Ted Leo has made her feel as though she's in a rock band for the first time, which must make her old bandmates in Till Tuesday feel a tad dismayed. But if anything, the both includes some of the most Amy Mann-ish of Amy Mann songs, the way her best singing captures an urgent longing and pessimism that's redeemed by a prickly self-awareness. Both work so well as an album because its songs cohere as the documentation of the ways a new creative partnership revitalizes the familiar habits, tics, tricks, and talents of the collaborators. It sets their individual talents in a new context that compels the listener to form a new appreciation for these musicians. They may begin the album singing about a gamble that didn't pay off, but their own musical collusion really has.
Ken Tucker reviewed Amy Mann and Ted Leo's new album and band, The Both. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross.
Hello! Woo! I got seven words for you. I love Ghoulie Bibs integrated multi-platform functionality! Yeah!
What happens when young computer geeks who become millionaires live among thousands more who hope to is the subject of the new HBO series Silicon Valley, created by our next guest, Mike Judge. Farhad Manju of the New York Times wrote that Silicon Valley finds comedy in the humdrum annoyances of life on a peninsula overflowing with money, ambition, and very little style. Mike Judge created and did some of the voices for the animated series Beavis and Butthead and King of the Hill, and he wrote and directed the movies Office Space, Idiocracy, and Extract. I spoke to Judge last week, and we began with the scene from the first episode of Silicon Valley. A young programmer played by Thomas Middleditch has come up with a revolutionary program that he's been offered $10 million for, and his angst over whether to take the money or develop his own company leads to a panic attack and a visit to a Silicon Valley doctor, played here by Andy Daly.
So, you will survive. It's just a garden variety panic attack. Welcome to Silicon Valley. We see people like you all the time.
Really?
Yes.
Let's just have to make this decision by tomorrow.
Yeah. You know, a while back, we had a guy in here in almost the exact same situation. Take the money or keep the company.
What happened?
Well, a couple months later, he was brought into the ER with a self-inflicted gunshot wound. I guess he really regretted not taking that money.
He shot himself because he turned down the money?
Yeah. Or no, he took the money. Or no. He did not. You know what? I don't remember. But whatever it was, he regretted it so much that he ended up shooting himself, and now he's blind.
He's blind?
Yeah, just FYI, if you're ever going to shoot yourself, don't hold the gun up to your temple, okay? Because that just basically took out both of his optic nerves and then, you know, half of his face. Then his wife left him because, you know, yikes.
Right.
You know, he may have been a genius programmer, but not so much with human anatomy. Or decision-making, for that matter. Now he's got to live with all that and whatever terrible decision he made about the money.
Do I do if I feel another panic attack coming on?
Would you be interested in a device that links up to your smartphone and it keeps track of your vitals and it tells you, even before it's happening, whether you're having a panic attack or an actual heart attack?
Yeah, that sounds great.
You would, right? Yeah. Okay, that's great news because it's still in prototype phase right now, but my startup partners and I are looking for investors, like today. So will you please let me know? I'm going to give you my number.
And that is from the series Silicon Valley, created by our guest Mike Judge. Mike Judge, welcome back to Fresh Air. Everybody's got an app. Everybody's got an angle. You want to just say a little bit about what inspired that scene?
Yeah, that, you know, in doing this, we've actually had extras on the set pitching their apps to actors. We've had, even before people knew I was doing this, I've had people pitch me apps just because, you know, they think I'm richer than I am or something. And, that just came out of, I just figured we had to have something in there where as soon as people smell money around the guy, they just start pitching him ideas. And that's kind of a running thing throughout the series, actually.
You know, there are shows about occupations, you know, cops and detectives and lawyers and even Hollywood agents. What's the appeal of a show about the tech world?
Well, the tech world is, it's become really interesting to me, especially in recent years, just watching these personality types, the kind of people I knew in college and in my brief engineering career, just knowing those types and seeing them suddenly have billions and billions of dollars is just, there's something funny about it to me.
You know, maybe you could describe a moment. It's really at the very beginning of the first episode when, you know, a company has been acquired by Google for $200 million. And they have Kid Rock there, because why not if you're throwing a party at that level? And tell us about the interaction with the engineers.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's back before the first dot-com bubble burst. I actually went to a party for a website launch that had a lot of money behind it. And I just went because Run DMC was playing. I was just kind of shocked at how, you know, here's Run DMC, this legendary great hip-hop group, and just the way the audience was just kind of talking amongst themselves, and I don't know, it was just kind of a funny scene. So that's that. And also I have a few rock star friends, and I happen to know that they play parties like this occasionally. They kind of look at it as a paid rehearsal, so I just thought that would be a funny way to open it. And then there's the Ghoulie Bib guy, who
That's the company that gets bought by Google, right? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, Javed. And yeah, Ghoulibib is acquired by Google. They're throwing this big party, and he gets up there and tries to do a Steve Ballmer kind of thing, which is already Steve Ballmer was probably trying to do somebody that really is good on stage. But that's what's kind of funny, is seeing these people that they have so much money that no one's going to tell them, hey, you shouldn't get a microphone and be on stage like that.
Tell us a little about your work as an engineer. You worked for a company called Parallax, is that right? It sounds like something you'd make up.
No, that was the second company I worked for. Uh-huh. All the companies I worked, well, the first two definitely sound like made-up names. The first company was called Support Systems Associates Incorporated. It's got such a ring to it. But the second one was called Parallax Graphics. They made these hardware interface cards for the early high-resolution screens, which weren't being sold to the public. It was for very niche, kind of like, I think police departments were buying them for fingerprint technology and the military, stuff like that. So these were things that cost, like, I don't know, around $5,000. I remember they cost the same amount as a Hyundai did at the time.
And were there ways that you and the guys that you worked with, I assume there were guys, ways that they kind of, I don't know, interacted and what they did with their social time that made its way into Silicon Valley?
Yeah, I mean, I never socialized with these guys or much of anybody back then. What was different then is that the barrier to entry to starting your own company was higher. It would take more money to do that. I think it's easier to do now. If I'd been born 25 years later, I might maybe be doing a startup because, you know, just if you have five people who program, you can just start doing it. I mean, everyone owns computers and phones. Back then, hardly anybody even owned a PC, you know, so it was kind of a different world as far as trying to start your own company, but it was very, very much the same personality types. But there's not a specific thing that I can think of. That job probably inspired Office Space a little more. I mean, my first week there was I was a test engineer, and so we were, you know, I won't bore everyone with what exactly we were doing, but I needed a set of schematics from the guy who sat at the station next to me, and I said, okay, can I borrow the RT schematics? And he just goes, nope. And I thought he was joking. I just kind of laughed, and so he goes, nope, I'm serious. Nope. Everyone keeps taking them and not bringing them back. I'm not loaning them out. And it was just this, it just kind of made me miserable. Just thought, okay, so this is the guy I'm going to be sitting next to for 12 hours a day.
I thought we'd play another clip here. This is from episode 3, and it's a TV advertisement for one of the big software companies in the series called Hooli. It kind of explains itself. Let's listen.
The greatness of human accomplishment has always been measured by size. The bigger, the better. Until now. Nanotech. Smart cars. Small is the new big. In the coming months, Hooli will deliver Nucleus, the most sophisticated compression software platform the world has ever seen. Because if we can make your audio and video files smaller, we can make cancer smaller. And hunger, and AIDS.
Well, so do people in Silicon Valley really believe that what they do is going to make the world better, or is that just, you know, some trope they say?
Well, I mean, I suppose some of the stuff they're doing is making the world a better place. What's interesting to me is it always seems to be this obligatory thing that they have to throw in there. I mean, there some people are making the world a better place, some maybe aren't, but it's just funny that most of it's just capitalism. They're trying to make their company as big and profitable as possible, which is fine, but it's always shrouded in this "we're making the world a better place" stuff. Like a company trying to put internet in all these third world African countries, and maybe they are making the world a better place for these places. They're also making a ton of money doing it. They don't talk about that as much, which is fine. It's just I just look at it as just it's just kind of funny. And when we got greenlit to series, I took all the writers. We went to an incubator, and they bring out their first company, and it's a company, and it's five guys, and it's one East Indian and one Asian, just like our ratio we have in the pilot. And then they pitch their app, and then the end of it, the guy just kind of throws in, like, he goes, you know, and making the world a better place. oh, yeah, I almost forgot. Yeah,
part of the formula, right.
Yeah, and so I don't know, I just think that's kind of funny. It's almost like a religion, like that, you know, you have to say amen at the end of something. Oh, yeah, and we're making the world a better place, yeah.
Well, Mike Judge, the last time you were on Fresh Air, Terry talked to you about Beavis and Butthead and Hank, King of the Hill, and you did some great characters there, such as Hank and Boomhauer. One thing that you didn't talk about that I want to talk about is the film Office Space, 1999, which in my family people regularly quote lines from to one another. it wasn't a huge box office hit, but people love it on DVD. It's about life in a workplace, right?
Yeah, I mean, I worked in cubicles, and it started out, it was the very first thing I ever animated that I finished with sound and everything was a two-minute short called Office Space, and it was in 1990. I was going to do just a series of just office character types that I had known, and that's how it began. And then Fox, when I had a deal with them, and King of the Hill had happened, and Peter Chernin, who was I guess he ran the whole News Corp at the time, but he just always liked Milton, the Office Space cartoons that I'd done, and
right, you can find
wanted a movie out of it.
You can find that short on YouTube, and it you will recognize
unfortunately,
those,
though,
those characters.
One thing I got to say about the YouTube one, and I as a user of YouTube, what bugs me is I made that short in my house with I timed every syllable with a stopwatch. I shot everything one frame at a time, meticulously got the lip sync really, really perfect, and it's on YouTube like a second out of sync. So it's just for all the world to see after all my work on that. I but yeah, you know, check it out and maybe imagine that it's in sync.
Yeah, trust me, it works. It works. I wanted to listen to a scene from Office Space, and in this we hear Peter Gibbons, who's the main character, played by Ron Livingston. I should say central character. It's kind of an ensemble cast. Peter Gibbons, who's played by Ron Livingston, works at this company called Inatech, hates his job. It seems pointless. He has too many bosses who don't seem to really have much to contribute but are always around. And the scene we're going to hear, he's already heard from several people that there are these monthly reports he has to turn in. I think they're called TPS reports. And now they're supposed to have cover sheets, but he forgot the first time to put on the cover sheet. And in the scene, we're going to hear his boss, Bill Lumberg, who is played by Gary Cole, comes by his cubicle to tell him about what else, the sheets. Let's listen.
Hello, Peter. What's happening?
We have sort of a problem here.
Yeah, you apparently didn't put one of the new cover sheets on your TPS reports.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry about that. I forgot.
Yeah. You see, we're putting the cover sheets on all TPS reports now before they go out.
Did you see the memo about this?
Yeah, I have the memo right here. I just forgot, but it's not shipping out till tomorrow, so there's no problem.
Yeah. If you could just go ahead and make sure you do that from now on, that would be great. And I'll go ahead and make sure you get another copy of that memo. Okay?
Yeah, no, I have the memo. I've got it. It's right.
Hello, Phil. What's happening?
And that is Gary Cole and Ron Livingston from the movie Office Space, written and directed by our guest Mike Judge. The persona of the boss there, you know, played by Gary Cole Lumberg, that whole, like, you know, yeah, what's happening? If you could just take that. This was somebody you knew, or where did that come from?
It wasn't any specific person. It started, I worked at Whataburger, which is a Texas, New Mexico chain of a burger place, and I worked at Jack in the Box. This was when I was young. And the worst thing ever at both those jobs is to change the fryers. And it's funny the way a boss will say, yeah, Mike, why don't you go ahead and change the fryers? And it's to say go ahead, and it's as if you were just chomping at the bit to go do it, and I'm just going to cut you loose and go ahead. And, I mean, it just now it's so commonplace. I think in the 50s, a boss would say, hey, Milton, move your desk. Thanks. And then I don't know if it's the baby boom generation or everyone has to be cool. In the 70s and 80s, it turned into like, yeah, if I could get you to just go ahead and move your desk. And it's just this kind of, oh, I'm casual, I'm cool, I'm not your 50s boss. And I would just prefer someone just coming up and telling you what to do. I would respect more. But I guess to answer your question, though, that kind of evolved out of that. And then also just even, you know, over the years, like just the, just noticing the yeah that means no. Like if you say, right. Oh, can I have Friday off? Yeah.
You know, I wonder if when you were, you know, pitching this to studios or talking to them about it, one of the issues might have been that people in studios, a lot of them really haven't had the experience of, you know, the daily drudgery of an ordinary job.
Oh, well, definitely. I mean, when it came time to, you know, when it was, when the thing was shot and they were looking at cuts of it, yeah, none of them really, I mean, none of these people I had dealt with had ever worked the really lousy jobs and, or even above lousy. I mean, you know, and I respect and like a lot of these people I work with, but people in the studio system tend to come from really upper-class families. They tend to have gone to good universities and not have had to work at Jack in the Box and Whataburger and just kind of menial, just, you know, office data-crunching type jobs. So yeah, a lot of them didn't know what it was, but you know, then eventually they wanted a sequel, so somebody...
It connected somehow, yeah.
Somebody out there liked it, yeah.
when people meet you, is there a scene from Office Space that they tend to recite back to you?
Usually it's just a little bit of Lumberg doing the, you know, the scene you played earlier, the, yeah. And I was in a Starbucks, actually, in Austin with Eitan Cohen, who I was writing with at the time, and the people behind the counter started going, yeah. And Eitan was looking at me like, oh, do they know who you are? And I said, no, I don't think so. And then at some point, the guy goes, have you guys heard of that movie? Have you seen that, Office Space? And Eitan said, oh, he wrote and directed it, and they didn't believe me.
Well, Mike Judge, it's been fun to have you back. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Mike Judge created the new HBO series Silicon Valley, which airs Sunday nights at 10. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.